Morning, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs to order. It is now 8:06 a.m. on Tuesday, April 30th, 2019, in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Tallarico, Representative Ortiz, Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Zilkuski, Chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Before we begin, I would like to thank Julia Bushman, the Secretary from Records, and Doug Bridges from the Juneau LIO for staffing the committee today. Today, we will be hearing about the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, as well as hearing House Bill 142, sponsored by Representatives Christ Tompkins, Ortiz, and Hannon. We will begin the presentation this morning with the Alaska Women's Resource Center, the Urban Indian Health Institute, and Central Council for Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. We will then move on to hear House Bill 142 regarding Native organizations operating the Village Public Safety Officer Program and the temporary assistance for needy families. So this morning, let's begin with a presentation on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls with a presentation by Michelle Demert of the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center. Ms. Demert, are you on the line?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. We have your presentation queued up, and committee aide Grace Singh will be advancing your slides forward when you indicate. So if you could begin by putting your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Okay, very good. So good morning, everyone. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today. My name is Michelle Demert. I am the law and policy consultant for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, and am an enrolled citizen for Tlingit and Haida, as also the Chief Justice for them. So I will be speaking to you today in my role as a law and policy consultant for the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, and I've been asked to provide testimony on the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, as well as to provide a presentation on pending federal laws that may be of assistance to you all in your work. So, so Grace, if you could pull it to the third slide, please. So missing and murdered Alaska Native women, or MMIW, is a far too common occurrence and recently has received much more attention due to many race voices having put the issue in the public eye for the last few years. Unfortunately, missing and murdered Indigenous women didn't just start happening a few years ago, but has been happening since first contact with outsiders coming into Indigenous Alaska lands. There are many stories and experiences of Alaska Native women and girls that have faced victimization just because they are Indigenous women. Too many of our relatives have suffered abuse and death because of a government system that fails in their legal trust and moral responsibility to assist Indigenous nations in safeguarding the lives of our women and children. There are many reasons why we have such huge challenges in Alaska and in protecting Alaska Native women and children when there is no help available, such as safe shelters, law enforcement, medical services, or any type of help dealing with the aftermath of victimization. The following are some of the explanations and solutions. We have no closure with many of our women who die unexpectedly and unnaturally. The manner of death, while it is far too often considered suspicious and often with visible injuries, are classified as accidental, suicidal, or undetermined. In the village of Kowak, which is where my family is from, police suspected foul play in the unnatural death of Francie Ella Turpin, 37, on January 14, 2018. A year later, there is still no resolution. Why is it that our women and families do not get the closure regarding a cause of death that other nationalities and the general population take for granted? Well, perhaps it's that 40% of our communities have no law enforcement or even any 911 services to speak of, so who do they call? The first responders are often volunteer medics whose first inclination is to address the injury. The possibility that there could be a crime committed is not even contemplated, and the scene can easily be contaminated before a semi-qualified individual can preserve the scene. Other potential first responders are tribal leaders and our volunteer women advocates who go to attempt to preserve any crime. Often the question is why. I believe debt is a simple but complicated, tragic truth that colonization, laws and policies that endanger Alaska Native women and children in resource development. Oftentimes, the attitude of people coming into our lands is that because of the lack of infrastructure, such as police and services that offer quick protection and justice systems that generally hold perpetrators of crimes accountable, is missing, and it sends a message of lack of care for our people. It has to do with a long history and belief that Native people are less valuable and a barrier to land and resources. Indian and Alaska Native women have often been objectified and considered of little importance and a means to an end. As for missing persons, Alaska has the highest number of any state in the Union, and these are not per capita numbers. As of January 2019, out of the 347 missing Alaska Native and American Indian peoples in the NAMIS system, that's a federal database volunteer system, 74 individuals of those were from Alaska, most of any state. Overall, 92% have been missing for less than a year, and the majority of cases are male, about one-third to two-thirds respectively. So why does it take so long to work our cases compared to other populations? As for the murder epidemic, the Violence Policy Center reports that Alaska is ranked first among states with the highest homicide rates of women by men and is the most violent state, with Anchorage as the most violent city within the Union. The Seattle-based Urban Indian Health Institute reports that Alaska is among the top 10 states with the highest number of missing and murdered Native American and Alaska Natives, with 52 active cases. In some communities, Native American, our women, are murdered at 10 times the national average. 10 times. These statistics are unacceptable. Sadly, Alaska is a violent state. According to the Violent Death Reporting System, between 2003 and 2008, Alaska Natives and American Indians make up 29.1% of the homicide victims in Alaska, with the 20 to 29 age group seeing the largest number of murders, 22.1%. That's so unacceptable. In addition, during that time period, Alaska Native and American Indian women represented 38% of the overall deaths, with a firearm being the number one cause killing our women, 29%. In addition, the perpetrator in the murders of Alaska Native and American Indian women were generally not domestic violence or intimate partner related. The majority of deaths were non-DV related, or 86.1%. So, I come from a fishing family in Southeast Alaska, and this is the metaphor that we use. We need a hands-on-deck approach to this crisis. At the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, we are putting together a community engagement plan to address when a person goes missing or dies by an unnatural death. This plan will address the services, public statements, legal issues and resources, the governmental roles, and other resources needed. We will have grassroots monthly public calls to ensure that we are understanding the issues and how the plan will work with various community models. We cannot wait for the state or federal government to act. However, there are solutions that a state can take. Many states are adopting a similar bill to the Savannah's Act, which I'll get into in a minute. In Washington State, they've undertaken a couple of pieces of legislation that have made a difference, or will make a difference. In last year, they had the Washington State Patrol study the issue and make recommendations through legislation. Just last week, in year two, they are implementing those recommendations and have two dedicated tribal liaisons within the Washington State Patrol to address these issues and to develop a best practices protocol when a woman goes missing. In other states, Montana, which has another epidemic in terms of similar to Alaska, the state has established fatality reviews back in 2003, and they review these cases, make comparisons with non-Native deaths, and try to work towards creating protocols and recommendations to lawmakers. Excuse me. In addition, this year they have created a grant funding network to collect and share data on missing people within Montana's seven Indian reservations. So they are trying to loop in the Native communities to address these crimes through legislation. The North Dakota legislature has passed a bill that would require more law enforcement training related to missing and slain Native Americans. South Dakota, there are three bills pending that are similar to the ones that I've just mentioned. So, you know, in terms of what can happen, there are bipartisan co-sponsors in the Senate back in D.C. who are addressing Savannah's Act, which includes several provisions aimed at improving the response to cases of missing and murdered women in tribal communities. We need perhaps the state to have a similar type of act to start creating the data to address these issues. So in terms of moving on, I have been also asked to give an update on some of the federal laws that are pending that are addressing some of these violent issues against Native American women. But before I do, are there any questions or is it okay to proceed?
Ms. Demmert, I do want to follow up and ask if you can be sure to provide in writing an overview of the statistics that you provided to us this morning. I think I saw a couple of us kind of scrawling really quickly as fast as we could. So if you wouldn't mind providing that to my committee aide, we can get that information to members of our committee. I do also want to take this moment to recognize that Representative Fields and Representative Story have both joined us this morning. Ms. Demmert, please continue.
Okay, thank you. I actually have some written testimony that I can send to your staffer to put into the record.
Great, thank you.
So, Grace, if you could put it on advance the PowerPoint, please. So the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center, I just want to give a brief overview. We were funded in 2017 appropriations for a state tribal resource center. We are the first Native resource center state-specific in the nation because of the combination of population of Native Americans as well as the issues that need to be addressed in terms of violence against American Indian and Alaska Native women. We provide technical assistance and training, including needs assessment, public awareness, resource development, policy development, and system advocacy engagement, and research and knowledge development. Next slide, please. So now I'm going to get into the pending federal legislation that is available and just to give you all an overview. The Violence Against Women Act. Next slide, please. The VAWA reauthorization history is important to understand. It was first enacted in 1994, and in that first year, it was mostly just to address the issues nationwide that the crimes were not acceptable and that they needed to be addressed. It's been reauthorized in 2000, 2005, and 2013. Each reauthorization has strengthened the law and includes provisions enhancing safety for Native victims of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, stalking, and trafficking. And in 2005, next slide, please, slide 8. In 2005, Title IX was created, which was a specific title to create the safety for Indian women. This was a historic amendment for Indian country because it created findings specific to our communities that were unacceptable and set in motion provisions for correcting the outrageous rates of domestic violence. It also created the requirement for the federal government to have annual government-to-government consultations with American Indian and Alaska Native tribes, and it created also a tribal deputy director and a tribal unit for administering these programs. Next slide, please. In VAWA 2013, there was once again a historic amendment. It restored the inherent tribal authority of Indian tribes to prosecute non-Native domestic violent perpetrators who committed certain crimes. There's what's called the partial Oliphant fix. The Oliphant case is a 1978 Supreme Court case of Oliphant versus Suquamish, in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that Indian tribes did not have jurisdiction over non-Indians any longer because of federal legislation, and that the only way for Indian tribes to assume that inherent authority was for federal legislation to provide a fix. Next slide, please. The special domestic violence court jurisdiction was limited in scope. It meant it could only apply to domestic violence crimes, violations of protection orders, and the defendant must have close ties to the community. So it wasn't just any stranger that wandered on the reservation. He or she had to have some sort of tie to the community. Next slide, please. Valor 2013, the effect of it was that only one tribe in Alaska could exercise this special domestic violence court jurisdiction because it's tied to what's called Indian country. And because of another Supreme Court case, the Venati versus Alaska, Indian country in Alaska is limited. Next slide. So this year, House Bill 1585, which passed last month, was the reauthorization of VAWA 2019, and it had significant improvements for American Indian and Alaska Native, as well as Alaska Native specifically. So it reauthorized the provisions for exercising special domestic violence court jurisdiction and expanded it to include obstruction of justice type crimes, sexual assault crimes, sex trafficking and stalking. And for Alaska, in order for us to participate, it will create up to a pilot project for up to five tribes to exercise this type of jurisdiction within certain parameters, and will define the jurisdictional boundaries for the Indian tribes for those five individual communities. And it will, so that's pretty significant, as well as you'll see on the screen, it provides tribal access program to tribes without law enforcement, which is another significant provision for Alaska tribes. The tribal access program gives American Indian Alaska Native tribes access to the federal criminal database to, figure out who's coming onto their reservation committing these crimes, what their background is, and being able to enter directly protection orders and things of that kind into that. Next slide, please.
Ms. Demmert, before you move on to the next slide, on point two on House Bill 1585, do you know who those five Alaska tribes are? Has that been selected? Is there an application process?
Okay, so this is just the House version, and so the Senate has not even introduced a version of VAWR yet. It's being worked on by Senate staffers, because we have a new judiciary chair, Senator Graham, he has been controlling how VAWA will be introduced, and it's been delayed because of all of the other things that they have going on in D.C. And so we're hoping that the Senate version will include the five, the same provisions that you see here. But it would have to be, tribes would have to apply, and there would be criteria that would be established for them to apply, and then there would be access to resources to create their laws and some of the infrastructure that would be needed in order to exercise this type of jurisdiction.
Got it. Thank you.
Sure. So slide 13. So one of the specific findings in Title IX that will be added, hopefully also in the Senate version, is the recognition that in Alaska has some special issues. And this is the finding in the legislation that the House just passed, which essentially it comes from the Tribal Law and Order Commission report, which was issued in 2013 and studied the status of crimes across Indian nations. It had a special chapter, chapter 2 on Alaska. If you've not read it, I would encourage you to read it, and I can certainly provide that to Grace as well. But they studied the situation in Alaska, and they found that Alaska Native women are overrepresented in the domestic violence victim population by 250%, and they comprise only 19% of the state population, but are 47% of reported rape victims. And remember, most rapes are not reported. And among other Indian tribes, Alaska Native women suffer the highest rates of domestic and sexual violence in the country. So this is the finding that was put in the House bill, which is significant because it will allow access to specialized programs to address these disproportionate rates of violence. Next slide, please. So getting back to the pilot project that Representative just asked about, Indian Country will be for up to five tribes. Indian Country for those five tribes will be defined in the following manner, that there will be the definition of Indian Country will include Alaska Native town sites, allotments, former reservation lands acquired in fee by Alaska Native corporations. And Representative Young expanded the jurisdiction to include all lands within any Alaska Native village with a population that is at least 75% Alaska Native. And so if the Senate picks this up, and you know, we've been in discussion with Senator Murkowski's office, and we think that she's supportive, but we don't know what the Senate bill will look like at this point. Next slide, please. Also, protection order. There's a protection order provision that pertains to Alaska to strengthen the enforcement to all lands in Alaska. Okay, next slide. Marker bills. There are several marker bills. These are, of course, as you know, are not intended to be standalone bills, but are intended to be part of a bigger bill. Next slide. The Native Youth and Tribal Officer Protection Act was introduced by, co-sponsored by Senator Murkowski, and it again reaffirms tribal criminal jurisdiction over some crimes committed by non-Indians, including child abuse and crimes against public safety and justice officials. And so this is similar to expanding the Special Domestic Violence Court jurisdiction in that it, you know, it's very rare that domestic violence occurs in isolation. There's usually other crimes that occur during the incident, including resisting arrest, property damage, things like that. So, and it also, our elders and children could be involved in the domestic violence as well. And so having a mechanism to prosecute for those crimes is important. Next slide. And then there's another bill called Studying the Missing and Murdered Indian Crisis Act. This was introduced by Senator Tester of Montana. As you know, as I mentioned, Montana has high rates as well. And it directs the Comptroller General to submit a report on the response of law enforcement agencies around this issue. Next slide. There's the Justice for Native Survivors Sexual Violence Act, which was, again, co-sponsored by Senator Murkowski, and it reaffirms tribal criminal jurisdiction over some crimes committed by non-Indians, including sexual assault, stalking, and trafficking. Again, a lot of our women are being, unfortunately, raped or having other sexual violence committed against them, and no one's taking those crimes up. And so that's another gap that Congress has recognized. So other Senate bills to watch, next slide, go to slide 21, please. The Survive Act, which is the Victims of Crime for Tribes Act, this would direct 5% of the total annual outlays for the Crime Victims Fund to be provided to Indian tribes. Indian tribes have just recently gotten access to the Crime Victims Fund directly last year and this year, and this is right now, the access has only been through appropriations, so it's been on a year-to-year basis. or the Survive Act will actually make it more permanent. The next slide, Surveillance Act, which is what I mentioned earlier, aims to improve the response to missing and murdered Native women by improving tribal access to the Federal Criminal Information Database. It requires data collection on missing and murdered Native people and directs the U.S. attorneys to develop law enforcement justice protocols to address missing persons. You know, in Alaska in particular, we've been a little bit concerned because we don't have the same federal presence with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and so we're concerned that unless some provisions get strengthened in the Surveillance Act, that we might be missing out on some of the safeguards there. Next slide, 23. So ways to strengthen the bill. We have a lot of deaths in Alaska classified as unnatural, but the manner of death is determined accident, suicidal, or undetermined, even though there are injuries, unexplained injuries that indicate some sort of trauma, unnatural trauma. And so, as I mentioned earlier, Crenshaw Turpin, if you Google it and get a news report, it comes up and says that you know, the crime was, or the death was suspicious, but again, more than a year later, no one is held accountable. So that I'm real concerned about the fact that there could be, we might miss data by classifying deaths as in these three areas, and they won't be captured in the Surveillance Act. So with that, I thank you for your time and your attention, and I'm happy to stay on for questions. I will provide written comments so you all can have those references that I made earlier in my oral testimony.
Don't see any at this time, Ms. Demmert. We appreciate your time with us this morning and that very comprehensive update on what's happening and all of the statistics. And we appreciate receiving written follow-up so that we can provide that really data-heavy information to all of the members of our committee. We also know that you have a long day ahead of you and you do a lot of work to strengthen capacity of our tribal courts in the state. So I just want to take a moment to say thank you so much for presenting before the committee today.
Yes, of course. I'm at, up in Fairbanks at the Chana Chief Conference, Judicial Conference, and which is very well attended, very well, people are here just excited to be partners with the state, I believe, but also to really strengthen their communities and make them safer for all of them. So thank you very much.
So now we will turn our attention to a presentation by the Urban Indian Health Institute, which is the research division for the Seattle Indian Health Board. Is Aaron Spark with the Urban Indian Health Institute on the line?
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for having me. I'd like to thank the committee and Chair Zlotkowski for shedding a light on missing and murdered Indigenous women and also bringing forth legislation. It's a very big deal to me. I grew up in Bethel. My family's from Chivac. I'm originally enrolled with ONC, but I'm moving my family over to Chivac Native Corporation along with my two daughters. So I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the November 2018 report that the Urban Indian Health Institute did, but I want to give you just a little bit of background on who I am and why I'm even talking to you this morning. I work for the Seattle Indian Health Board, which also has the Urban Indian Health Institute, which is one of 12 tribal epidemiology centers throughout the United States. The Urban Indian Health Institute is the only one over the entire country.
Just for the purpose of making sure that we get our minutes correct, if you could just begin by putting your name and affiliation on the record and then begin.
Okay. My name is Aaron Spark, and I'm representing the Seattle Indian Health Board and the Urban Indian Health Institute.
Thank you so much. Please continue.
Okay. And then, so again, with the Seattle Indian Health Board and the Urban Indian Health Institute. So through our work, we work in 25 different states throughout the United States and have partnerships with over 130 tribes. So we offer technical assistance and policy analysis work for all 25 of those states for anybody who asks for it, a lot of it dealing with federal legislation. We have a policy platform working with our community, tribal, and federal and our government partners. So I want to give you a little bit of background of the report. Understand that I am not the author of the report. Abigail Echohawk, who directs our Tribal Epidemiology Center, the Urban Indian Health Institute, is that person. She co-created this report along with Anita Lucchese. Before that, in 2017, when we were trying to find out if there was a comprehensive list of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, we found that there was one person, a PhD student, Anita Lucchese, who is keeping this database. So we decided to partner with her and create this report, which is part two of a three-part series. And the next report that we should be releasing in November will deal with Alaska specifically. So what the report is, we released this report, and it's canvassing data from 71 cities across 29 states. The study sought to provide a comprehensive snapshot of the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis in the urban Native communities and why obtaining data on this violence is so difficult and how law enforcement agencies are tracking and responding to these cases. The collection was not easy. Across 29 states, we had a lot of FOIA requests and found that there was a lot of things wrong with this. It brought to light poor record keeping and consistent racial misclassification of American Indians and Alaska Native women and girls, as well as flaws in the FOIA request process itself, which grants any person the right to request access to federal agency records or information. We do want to point out that the state of Alaska was very responsive to this, but still, looking across all different types of agencies, especially when dealing with tribal lands, the data collection reporting is still needs work across the country. So what this does, it showcases a severe lack of quality data and accessibility for data on violence experienced by Native women and girls. And then ultimately, this report gives you the advocacy for policy and systems change that would create meaningful change to end violence experienced by American Indian and Alaska Native communities. In the report, we found 507 cases nationwide. 127 cases were of missing Indigenous women, 282 were cases of murdered Indigenous women, and 98 cases were with an unknown status. And of those, 153 cases were not in law enforcement records. So I do want to point out that the Anchorage Police Department was by far the most complicit police department that we had talked to throughout all the states. Again, with Anchorage being number three on the list with 32 cases, Alaska was number four overall for the states at 53 cases. But I do want to point out a piece of the data right here. Because of the lack of uniform data reporting and collection standards throughout the United States, we could not make uniform comparisons or analysis across the country, which is why we talk about places on an individual basis and talking about their data collection methodologies there. I'd like to also point out that 28% of the perpetrators were found not guilty or accountable, and 85% of the perpetrators were men, and 50% of those being non-Native. And I think it's very interesting to point out that, as according to the Centers for Disease Control, murder is the third leading cause of death for American Indian Alaska Native women. If people will listen, that there are different ways that we can approach this to make it work a little bit better. I'm not saying that I'm not thankful for all the different pieces of legislation that are out there, and I thank Alaska, being my home state, for being one of these states to offer innovative approaches to addressing the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls crisis. So what we ask for in that one pager for the policy recommendations is engaging those communities that are most impacted, which means you have to work with the tribal communities. Alaska is a lot more complicated than a lot of other states because I think it's a public law 280 state, which means the jurisdiction of tribes does reside at the state level, but it does happen in partnership. And I know from growing up in Bethel, the VPSO and the VSO system that we have in the villages is one that's a little suspect. So, and I do say that only because when Abigail came back from Alaska, she came back with a story of a young woman who was found murdered on the steps of a church and had to stay there for 3 straight days. And a retired law enforcement official who was a tribal member from the community stood vigil over the body without moving anything, not to upset evidence, for those 3 days with her family, no more than 100 feet away praying over the body. And it was because law enforcement could not get there for 3 days that this happened. So engaging with the communities and also strengthening our systems is something that needs to happen. So making sure that consult policy, so the government-to-government aspect is taken care of, should be there. And investing in indigenous approaches is also something that is of extreme importance, which means investing in your tribal epidemiology centers. You have one up in Alaska. There are 12 throughout the country. And making sure that it's community-led demographic data collection and reporting standards that you are creating. When we say this, we mean we want you to work with us. The state bill in Washington, House Bill 1713, regarding missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, we were very happy that this was done. But the problem is although there are two tribal liaisons for the state highway patrol, as far as the data collection and reporting standards and methodologies, they are doing that in-house. So after our report was released, we found 45 cases in the state of Washington. When the highway patrol did it, even after our report release, they found only a fraction of those missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in the system. So that's what we're saying when we want those indigenous data reporting and collection methodologies created. We want to make sure that it's done from a perspective of Native people so we can understand this a little bit better. So that data discrepancy from one coming from an indigenous method to that of the state just shows you how stark that contrast is, and to make sure that investing in that indigenous methodology is a priority going forward in legislation. So I'm also looking at indigenous data sovereignty practices, which means respecting tribal sovereignty when we're doing this. The tribe does have the right to know, and it has the right to recourse while we're doing this. So that's the pieces that we're talking about as far as the tribal epidemiology centers, but also talking about investing in indigenous approaches to ending gender-based violence. This is a very large issue. It doesn't just touch the missing and murdered piece of that. We're also talking about domestic violence. Holistically, we need to look at this while creating the system. And I do say that this should be a partnership. It's very interesting to look at tribal systems, how they interact with municipal, county, state systems that are out there, and we'd like to just make sure that we're respectful of each other's jurisdiction and understanding that we're trying to do this together. I don't want any piece of these to be adversarial, and in some states we have seen a little piece of that because jurisdiction is a very large issue, even between municipal and state and federal pieces, but understanding that we're trying to get to the bottom of a crisis right now with a group of people that have a federal trust responsibility, that should be the driver and the motivator. And also while doing that, we're looking at the indigenous approaches to gender-based violence by setting aside money for services as well. And when we say that, as we're moving along to mandate improvements in data collection and reporting, we really do mean this. This has to happen from the top down. When we did a canvas of all the different pieces of legislation that are out there, we found out that it really is up to the area that has jurisdiction in the specific area to figure out what kind of data they're collecting and that they're reporting. This is a very lucky time, and I do say that. I'm very optimistic because I think Alaska can be the beacon for the rest of the country to say that we're doing this right. So we can create this system where all of our people, no matter where we are, we're collecting the right information, we're being respectful of tribal sovereignty as we're putting it into legislation. That's not an easy task, but it's a task that people are used to undertaking right now. You do have to report data no matter what, if you're taking federal funds or even if you're taking state funds. So this is a piece that can be worked with together so all parties can be held accountable. And again, including that accountability mechanism. So we're going to take away funding, but there's also an investment piece. People don't have the infrastructure to be able to collect this data and report it or even access the systems that they need to. So we're asking that as you're looking at this, we're also talking about funding an infrastructure package as we're going forward. So that is the general summary of what we have today. I don't want to take up too much of your time because there's a lot of information that you guys are going to be going over, but I'm happy to answer any questions. And again, thank you, Chair Zulkowski, for bringing this up. My brother and my family are still in Bethel. This is a very big deal to us. And in the Chupik culture and traditions, all of my mother's sister's children are my brothers and sisters, and their kids are my nieces and nephews. This is a very big deal for us to make sure we're protecting our communities. And anything that the Seattle Indian Health Board and the Urban Indian Health Institute can do to help, please just ask.
Thank you, Mr. Spark. Are there any questions from committee members? We don't see any. The one question that I would have is, you had mentioned that that UIHI is working on a second report that deals with Alaska specifically, but I missed the release date. Can you provide that again?
I believe it's going to be in November, and I think on Thursday you will have Abigail Echo Hawk testifying as well, so she can go into more of the report detail of how it affects Alaska and what kind of data they're collecting.
Great, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us this morning and all the work that you're doing on this issue.
Thank you.
Our last presenter on this topic this morning is President Richard Peterson of Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. President Peterson, if you could put your name and affiliation on the record and begin your presentation.
Good morning. Forgive my, I have a cold. Richard Peterson, I'm the president of Central Council Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska. And just want to say good morning to all the committee members. I'd like to thank you for your time this morning, especially this special committee on tribal affairs, because now important issues such as murdered and missing indigenous women come to the forefront of policy discussions in our capital. I believe this is probably the first time that this term, murdered and missing indigenous women, has probably been spoken at the Capitol. So gonna chishawa. Thank you. It should be no surprise to you that since statehood, the safety of Alaska Native women and girls have gone politically underprioritized. Even when the state was wealthy, rural public safety services have never been adequately funded. But well before statehood, during the times of Alaska Territory, sexual violence against indigenous women and children was a tool used by missionaries and boarding schools sanctioned and funded by the federal government to separate Alaska Native from their cultures and claim to their traditional homelands. This trauma affects my community and my family. I believe that it touches every single Alaska Native family in one way or another. The generational trauma of the boarding school generation continues to go largely unrecognized by the state and federal governments. But it is a crucial part of history that needs to be stated on the record, especially on the subject of missing and murdered indigenous women and the needs of public safety and behavioral health services in rural Alaska. Central Council Tlingit and Haida has been very active in bringing this issue to the forefront of our policy priorities. Last year, we organized a march for missing and murdered indigenous women during our annual tribal assembly, and this year we held another. These marches are in response to a murder that happened from my home island of Prince of Wales, where in 2016, a young woman, a mother was murdered and her case has still not been tried. Actually, is in trial this week, finally, 3 years later. These stories are all too common in rural Alaska. Because of a lack of resources, the troopers often tell our rural communities, call us when you have a body. When violence begins to escalate in our villages, but even then the troopers can still take days to be dispatched. You heard Mr. Spark testify in one of our communities of Cake. We've had several murders in that community of young women. In Kloak, we've had two that have gone unprosecuted. And every time it's taken several days for a response. The young girl, the mother that I just mentioned, her body laid in a rock quarry for several days, covered by a tarp, waiting for the proper law enforcement response. In our culture, that's not how we deal with our deceased. We have a process, and we have what we call night watch. We sit with the bodies 24 hours to make sure that they reach the next phase unharmed by other spirits. And so we're unable to practice our traditions. We're unable to care for our loved ones who often cannot be moved or touched so that the crime scene is not altered. So the problem is when this happens, we have to wait days, but in the same exact area, our traditional hunters can be prosecuted within hours for practicing traditional ways of life, such as getting a moose for a funeral potlatch. I was at a community public safety meeting in Cake just over a year ago, and the former magistrate there stood up and said to the commissioner of public safety, former commissioner, the people of Cake feel like moose are more valued to the state of Alaska than clinkets. This imbalance of public safety priorities is not just unjust, it is a pattern of oppression that has always been in Alaska. After last year's march, the Tlingit Haida delegation made the murdered missing indigenous women issue a priority for our tribe. Tribal Resolution 1837 established the Violence Against Women Task Force, which met for the first time in September of last year. And this year we elevated the MMIW issue further with a half day on tribal law and order presentations from a variety of speakers, including Chief Justice Michelle Demmert, including Tribal Affairs Committee aide Grace Singh. So thank you, Chairwoman, for making her available. In addition to the Tribal Law and Order Day, our keynote for our tribal assembly was Abigail Echohawk from the Seattle Indian Health Board's Urban Indian Health Institute, the author, co-author of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women November 2018 report. I found one of the most striking findings in the 2018 UIHI report is how the media and government illustrates the lives of these missing Native women, which often blames the victims of some of the most violent and heinous crimes by affiliating them with drugs, alcohol, prostitution, criminal histories, or not even naming them, not even acknowledging them as human with names. Maybe that's why this issue has been swept under the rug for so long. I don't know how the safety of Alaska Native women and girls can be a political decision. To me, that's just adequate governance. That's just barely meeting the expectations of a sovereign to keep citizens safe. I genuinely hope that the state of Alaska agencies, departments, lawmakers, and administration values the lives of Native women on the same level as every other citizen. Because tribes like Tlingit Haida are ready to join forces, share resources, and work together to better protect Alaska Native communities. These women and girls are humans, they have names, and they deserve protection. Thank you.
Thank you, President Peterson, for your testimony. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for your testimony today. That concludes the presentations that we have on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls for this morning's meeting. We do have a House bill that is up for a hearing today, and our representative who is giving the presentation is in another committee, so we will take a brief at ease. And we are back on record. We will now turn our attention to House Bill 142, an act relating to Alaska Native organizations, relating to the Village Public Safety Officer Program, and relating to the Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, which has been sponsored by Representative Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, Dan Ortez, and Sarah Hannon. Representative Christ-Tompkins, if you could come forward, as well as John Scanlon, staff to Representative Christ-Tompkins, put yourselves on the record and give us a brief recap of the legislation.
For the record, Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, District 35. Thank you, Madam Chair, for having us. House Bill 142 is effectively a technical housekeeping piece of legislation. As I think everyone on the committee knows, their Native entities administer the Village Public Safety Officer Program and Temporary Assistance Programs in Alaska. I guess not exclusively, the Northwest Arctic Bureau administers VPSOs in the Northwest Arctic, but generally speaking, this is a sort of an administrative reality. It's a partnership that the state of Alaska has endeavored for a long time. However, in the statutes, there's an ambiguity that relates specifically to Tlingit Haida Central Council, and Tlingit Haida Central Council has a nuanced, different legal identity than the other regional nonprofits that administer VPSO program and temporary assistance programs. And so House Bill 142 adds an additional sort of type of eligible organization to resolve that ambiguity and ensure that Tlingit Haida is fully eligible to continue administering these programs as it has for, I think, the past 20 plus years.
Chair Zelkowski, I would only add, at present, nonprofit regional corporations and quote unquote rural areas, which has its own specific definition, are eligible to administer a VPSO program. And this bill would add, quote-unquote, Alaska Native organizations to that. That's in that definition references statute of the 13 entities that are presently eligible to administer Alaska Native Family Assistance Programs. So when you cross-reference that list by adding, quote-unquote, Alaska Native organizations to the eligible entities to administer a VPSO program, you're in effect just adding Metlakatla and the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida. So I wanted to make that distinction. And then as relates to the Alaska Native Family Assistance Program, we would not, but by the technical fix we're making, we wouldn't be adding any other eligible entities. It would still be the original 13 that are outlined in statute. This would just ensure that those 13 are authorized under law to administer the family assistance programs at present, because the Central Council is a federally recognized tribe and not a regional nonprofit corporation. They're not actually technically authorized to administer the program, despite having done so for the past 20 years. And they have been working with the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Health and Social Services in the most recent grant cycle, and kind of those agencies and Tlingit and Haida collectively said, we're going to work toward yes and getting a statutory fix passed. We vetted this bill with the Department of Law, who had their Department of Public Safety and Department of Health and Social Services and tribal law attorneys all look through the bill. They said it has firm legal standing. There's no issues with the way it's drafted. So that's the upshot of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Scanlon, if we could just get you to restate your name and office affiliation for the record.
For the record, John Scanlon, staff rep, Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. So just a clarifying question. So it sounds you, Representative Christ Tompkins, you both have mentioned that this is a very narrow technical fix, which ultimately, I think because of the size and scope of the work that Tlingit and Haida does in Southeast, it's easy to think that they are very similar to other nonprofits because they do a lot of work in their community leaders in advancing issues around public safety and advocating for their tribal citizens. But the reality is that as a legal entity, they are a federally recognized tribe. And so this fix is a very narrow fix that, as you mentioned, Mr. Scanlon, if you could just confirm on record that this particular legislative language would only apply to Tlingit and Haida as well as the community of Metlakatla.
Chair Zelkowski, for the record, John Scanlon, staff rep, Chris Tompkins. That's correct as relates to the Village Public Safety Officer program. By adding this category, we would only be adding the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida and Metlakatla as entities that would be authorized or eligible to administer the program. They would still need to work with the Department of Public Safety in doing so. It's a kind of hand-in-hand process. And as relates to the Family Assistance Program, similar deal in which, you know, a lot of collaboration with the Department of Health and Social Services, but there would be no additional entities added under House Bill 142. It simply ensures that the 13 entities currently listed in statute as entities eligible to administer the Family Assistance Program are actually authorized under statute to do so.
Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Vance.
Thank you. excuse me. I'm a little confused because after going on the Department of Commerce Community Economic Development website, I found that Tlingit and Haida has a nonprofit corporation, regional VPSO corporation. And so wouldn't this qualify for doesn't this make Tlingit and Haida qualify for the requirements under the VPSO system that they're seeking?
Representative Vance, through the chair, All equal, I'd like to refer that question to President Peterson, who can speak to that. That was the initial step that Clinkett and Haida tried to take when the Department of Public Safety flagged that they were technically out of compliance, mm-hmm. and he can speak to why that's not a viable option in terms of a practical administration of the program.
Thank you. It also appears as though we have Captain Andrew Merrill from the Alaska State Troopers on the line, who, as I understand, is dispatched to the Sea Detachment, which he also provides support for the VPSO program. Captain Merrill, are you online?
Yes, Representative Vance, through the chair, I am on the line and available if needed.
Captain Merrill, this is Representative Zelkowski, and Representative Vance had asked a question about the nonprofit certification through DCCED for Clinkett and Haida's VPSO program. Are you able to answer? Did you hear her question, and are you able to answer it for us?
Yes, Madam Chair, I can answer that question for Representative Vance through the chair. So kind of a little brief history on the way this worked out is, I manage the VPSO program. That is one of the captain hats I wear. I also work recently when Colonel Wilson was promoted. I took over Sea Attachment as well. My name is Andrew Merrill, I'm with the Alaska Sea Troopers for the record, so we get that on there. So to answer the question, last year there was a lawsuit where VPSO and Clinkett Haida were sued civilly for the actions of the VPSO, and as part of that lawsuit, Clinkett Haida exercised sovereign immunity and was removed from the lawsuit. And in that lawsuit, the judge made, in his ruling, multiple notices to the state that technically Clinkett Haida was not a Native nonprofit as listed in the regulations and statutes. We began the program about 5 years ago. We've never really asked the question of the Native nonprofits to tell us they're Native nonprofits because they've all been participating. Like has been mentioned, Clinkett Haida has been managing the program off and on for quite a long time. But once we were put on notice, we recognized that that was an issue. So we worked closely with Clinkett Haida, and to help get into compliance, Clinkett Haida went through the task of establishing a nonprofit entity underneath their tribal organization to qualify technically under the law. And so they took that step to make sure they did qualify. And this is the, and I can let President Peterson speak about the any hardships that may cause to their organization to have that established nonprofit, but those are the steps that were taken and why that organization was formed.
Thank you, Captain Merrill. Is there a follow-up?
So does this qualify them for, are they now under compliance of the VPSO requirements?
Representative Vance, the chair, yes. This, the establishment of the nonprofit underneath the Native tribe of Clinkett Haida of Alaska does qualify them now, so they are legally, we are within compliance of the regulations and statutes.
Thank you, Captain Merrill. I think before we continue that line of questioning, we'll wait until we get to invited testimony so that the so that President Peterson can answer that. Are there any other questions for the sponsor or his staff? Thank you for presenting before the committee today. We will turn to invited testimony of House Bill 142. President Peterson, if you could come forward again, put your name on the record, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, and again, good morning. Richard Peterson, President Clinkett and Haida, for the record. Do you want me to directly answer the question? Or?
Sure, if you could begin by talking about the answering Representative Vance's question and then continuing with your invited testimony.
Sure, thank you. So we did comply, and anybody can basically go and register a company. That's pretty easy. It's actually the management of the company and is cumbersome, and it added another layer and costs. So, and this is a program that's already stretched pretty thin monetarily. So I think it's to both interests of the state and to the tribe to just get the statutory fix. And it's really just housekeeping, so very uncontroversial. And both the Department of Public Safety and Health and Human Services has been very supportive of this. So does that answer you, Representative Ants, through the chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. And again, good morning. Clinkett Haida has been carrying out this program successfully for over 20 years, both VPSO and TANF programs, through grant agreements with the state of Alaska. These programs are vital to the citizens both in Juneau and the surrounding villages, Southeast Alaska. So we operate TANF for the entire region, so every community from Ketchikan to Yakutat in Southeast. And then the VPSO program, we operate through a grant agreement with DPS, and then we work with local municipal governments. So if a community so wishes to have a VPSO, we work to place the VPSO in their communities. Of course, it's not without its hurdles. As everybody knows, it's very hard to recruit and retain those folks in those communities, but we've done a fairly good job over the last 20 plus years. As a regional tribe, Clinkett Haida is uniquely situated to carry out these programs for Southeast Alaska. As stated by Representative Christ Tompkins, in other regions, I think Northwest Arctic Borough is the exception, but the rest are tribal nonprofits, which are consortiums of tribes, whereas we're actually an anomaly. We're a regional tribe. But we're very, not just uniquely situated to carry these out, but I think we have the direct line to these communities. So we do a very, I think, great job of doing that. As stated by Captain Merrill, it came to our attention through this lawsuit that we were out of compliance through this statutes. So even though we're listed, we aren't defined as a tribal nonprofit. So we thought that seeking a statutory fix was the right thing to do to get us in compliance. We didn't want to add another layer of bureaucracy, costs, and just an encumbrance on operating the programs by having to do it through another shell, kind of like a shell, really. We thought the best and probably most genuine way was just a simple statutory fix. So we agreed that the fix was necessary and began working on that and getting the support for this. We know that right now there's ongoing conversations, budgetary issues around both TANF and VPSO, but we still think for the long term this is the best avenue. So this language that Representative Christ Tompkins has already discussed with the Department of Law and DHHS, and it's been informed that there's no legal issues or concerns, that this is written well and should be non-controversial.
Does that conclude your testimony? Yes. Thank you, President Peterson. Can you, before we let you go, and I appreciate you indulging us with your presence this morning, without this particular statutory fix, can you describe any potential hardships the tribe would face as it relates to managing the VPSO program?
Yeah, and forgive me, my voice is kind of cracking. So, right now it would just create another cost. We'd have another, it'd be kind of a pass-through, and we'd have to have organizational setup. And so right now, again, we've been carrying out these programs very successfully, and I think we're a model, quite honestly, for 20-plus years. So instead of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, it's just best to get a clean statutory fix.
So just in a follow-up question to that, so Clinkett and Haida would anticipate an increase in admin costs, which would potentially increase overhead and decrease the amount of funds that could go directly to the VPSO program?
Yes, and for the record, it would, correct, and for TANF.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions from committee members? Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
That concludes our invited testimony. We will now open HB 142 for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Seeing none,
I will look online, and I do not see any additional individuals online who wish to testify. So seeing no individuals who wish to testify to House Bill 142, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. We will be holding the bill at this time. This Thursday, May 2nd, we will hear additional presentations on the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. We will also be hearing a House resolution urging the United States Congress to reauthorize the Violence Against Women's Act, to support Savannah's Act, and to highlight the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. The time is 9:12 a.m., and this hearing of the House Special Committee on Tribal Affairs is now adjourned.